It's time for Sports Lit 101. And excited to talk to the author of a book that we've talked about a couple of times in the last few weeks. The book is entitled Spirals, A Family's Education in Football. And joining us is the author of the book. He's also vice president for academic development and a professor of American Studies at Middlebury College. The author of 100 Years on the Road, The Traveling Salesman in American Culture, Timothy B. Spears joins us. Tim, thanks so much for being with us.
Well, it's great to be here, Rich. How you doing? Hi, Bruce. Thanks for having me.
Oh, we're glad you're here.
Yeah, we love the book so much. And is it safe to say that more than anybody I think we've had on the show, Ivy League football is in your blood?
Yeah, that's definitely the case. And, you know, certainly in the writing of that book, I was, you know, I had to come to terms with what that all means.
Yeah. Well, I think what makes this book so compelling is that your grandfather, Doc Spears, is really one of the, I think the word, it's fair to say, seminal people in college football. And at the time when college football was far more popular than the game, a guy from the Midwest who ends up in Dartmouth and becomes a doctor. Could you just walk our listeners sort of through that part of the book or that part of the story?
Yeah, absolutely. I'd be happy to. Well, so, and you got to pull me back in if I go off the rails here. But, you know, when I first started writing this book, as I say in the book, I mean, I was waking up as a 40-year-old and I was having these anxiety dreams, and I was dreaming I was back at Yale playing football. And of course, in the back of my mind, I knew I wasn't. So that was the source of the anxiety. So I realized that there was something there, and in terms of my interest in the topic, and I started doing research. And, you know, throughout my growing up years, I'd heard all about my grandfather, Doc Spears, who was my father's father. And I started doing archival research. You know, it's sort of like sort of high-end genealogy. I started traveling to these various universities where my grandfather had coached and digging around in the archives and finding out as much as I could about Doc Spears. His full name was Clarence Wiley Spears. And what I found out in the course of that research is I, you know, put together a story or a history that looked, was a little bit different than what I'd heard growing up. So my father, who was a really great athlete in his own regard in Yale and, you know, was captain of the Yale football team in the early 50s, he idolized his grandfather. And I, you know, spent my entire growing up years, my brother and I, who we were very close in age and we both played sports, hearing all about my grandfather, and he was our hero and he was my father's hero. And so the story that we heard from my dad was a little bit different than the one that I found in the archives. I mean, they definitely overlapped, but as you guys know, if you've read some of the history, my grandfather was a bit of a hard case. He was a tough guy, as coaches often were back then. And I got a better sense of how the myth of my grandfather grew out of a reality that we hadn't talked about when I was growing up. So in any case, my grandfather, the short story on my grandfather is he grew up in a place called Kewaunee, Illinois. And he was a very good high school football player. He was very large. He was wide in any case. He was, 5'10", 240 pounds. He went to Knox College. He transferred from Knox to Dartmouth. He then went to medical school at the University of Chicago. In between time, he played for the Canton Bulldogs with Jim Thorpe. You know, legend has it, he rode the rail cars back to the Midwest and played for Canton just after he got out of Dartmouth. And then he went back to Dartmouth and he coached Dartmouth for a couple, 3 years very successfully. And then he was picked up by West Virginia, where he had a very successful stint as a coach. And this was in the early 20s. And then he went on to the University of Minnesota, where he also was quite successful and had a Coach Bronco Nagurski, another mythic figure in football history. And he left Minnesota in 1929, 1930, went to Oregon for a year or two, and then he went to Wisconsin, and he got fired at Wisconsin, and then he ended up in Maryland where he finished off his career, and he was replaced there, I think, by Bear Bryant. So, I mean, it was along the way, you know, he had this kind of very strange career in which he was coaching Big Ten football, you know, adversely at the time in which football was becoming a big time sport, right? I mean, so if you go back and look at the early history of, if you look at the history of college football, what ends up happening in the 1910s and 20s is that universities began to build these huge stadiums, football became a mass spectacle sport. And so my grandfather was very much a part of that. And yet at the same time, he was also practicing medicine. And it was very important for him at least so I learned, having looked at some of his, you know, written contracts and the like, that he'd be able to practice medicine while also coaching football. So, you know, I think in terms of how we understand the relationship between football and education, my grandfather is a pretty good example of somebody who sort of was able to do it all.
Well, the other thing I think is so fascinating, I mean, he intersects, as you mentioned, he discovers Bronco Nagurski out plowing in a field. He hangs out with Newt Rockne and all these people, and yet he had a very clear sense that he wanted your father not to go to Army and play there, but to go to Yale. He had a sense that the education that you got, I think, from reading the book, is where your opportunity really lies. You might be in football, but if you have that education, you always can do that. Is that a fair assessment?
No, I think you're right on there. I mean, my grandfather was a hard case in certain ways, but his commitment to education was unwavering. And I mean, and this is sort of a sidebar, but I mean, I came to understand that my dad, I got a lot of really good information about my grandfather from my father, but at a certain point, I didn't see my father as an entirely reliable authority on my grandfather. But in any case, yeah. So my grandfather had very strong opinions about where my father should go to college. And one of the things that I discovered in my research, which was really cool, was that, I mean, this was back in the day when, I mean, this stuff doesn't happen anymore, but, you know, in the 1920s, when he was coaching at the University of Minnesota, you know, he would go into the dormitories and look for, you know, potential football players. And I mean, one of his sort of guiding principle in working with these young men was to say, look, you know, you play football, you learn how to play football, I'll teach you how to play football, you'll be part of something bigger than yourself. And this is going to be a really important part of your education. And you will go out and you will, you know, you, by virtue of your participation on the football team, and yes, hard work in the classroom, you will succeed in life. And I think that for me is, you know, I find that kind of integration of sports and education really important. It's laudable. I think, you know, it hardly needs to be said that these days, at least, you know, when football is played at the highest level in college, it's hard to do, right? I mean, to go back to your original question, I think education was really important for my grandfather, and he certainly wasn't shy about telling my dad, you know, where to go to get the best education.
So you and your father both go to Yale. You both become captains of the football team.
Well, no, I was not a captain.
That's right. You're more a captain. Yeah,
I was a high school football captain. I'll give myself
right.
That.
That's what I was. That's what I confused. So you guys both go to Yale, and then you, at a time when Yale was playing a bigger brand of football than the Ivy League plays now. I think that's a fair assessment. When you look back at your father's success in business and your success in academia, and you don't get to be a tenured professor at Middlebury unless you've done very well, how much of that do you think sort of filters down from Doc Spears?
Well, you're sort of getting into the deep psychotherapy here. I mean, I've thought about that a lot. I mean, and, you know, in certain ways, temperamentally, I'm a little bit more like my grandfather in certain respects than my dad. I mean, I went to get a PhD, because I wanted to, you know, I loved learning. I wanted to do whatever exploration one does as an intellectual and on a college campus. My dad was not wired that way. He was, you know, much more sort of outer directed in terms of dealing with people. You know, I think that, not that I don't get along with people, but my dad was a salesman and I didn't want to be that guy. And, you know, I have nothing against salesmen because my dad was one after all. So what does it have to do with Doc? I mean, I kind of wonder if these things, you know, some of these traits do sort of pass down through the generations. I'm mostly a historian, so I can't really make the claim that these things are passed down through DNA or something like that. But I think that, and I talk about this in the book, I think a lot that because of my grandfather's commitment to education, I think, and my father's commitment to education as well, there was never any question when I was growing up that sports always had to be tied to learning. You know, and my mom was, you know, my parents were both together on that one. So the ethos in my family, I think, you know, like I can safely say, had something to do with my grandfather's commitment to the integration of the two. I think that's the case. Now, you know, I sometimes, by the way, I'm not an administrator anymore. I went back to the faculty full time this past July. But, you know, I will say that in my years of doing administrative work, as I was writing this book, I was certainly thought about my grandfather's relationship to administrators and the fact that he didn't really get along with most of them. You know, here I am spending most of my work life on a college campus in the same way that my grandfather did. You know, so I do think about it. And though I think, you know, if my grandfather were alive and I could talk to him about this, you know, I don't know what he would do and look at me when he said, "You're a faculty member? You got to be kidding me." But he was a faculty member. I mean, he was. He had that appointment when he was at a couple of different universities. So, you know, I don't know. It's a kind of, Bruce, it's a mystery. You know, I mean, this is one of the reasons why I think ultimately it's a mystery. And I think that one of the reasons why people write books like the one that I wrote, or people do genealogical research, or they, you know, they investigate the history of their families, is they want to get to that origin story, right? I mean, they want to understand how it is that I am the way I am. And they, you know, I think we all believe that has something to do with the families we grew up in. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. But one of the questions that I think we come up against, at least I have, is at what point, as we start to look into the past, does the, you know, that originating point disappear? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
We're talking with Timothy Spears. His book is Spirals of Families, Education, and Football. And I was fascinated in the book with the section you write about what was going on. Well, you call it the unsettling of Yale in the late 1960s. And how did that time period and everything that was going on in the country, how did that change the role of athletics at Yale and in the Ivy League in general?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And I think that, well, there are two answers. I think it changed fundamentally the relationship between the sport as an organized sport and the rest of the institution, right? Now, I have to say that, I mean, at Yale went co-ed several years before I got there. And my dad, when he was there in the 50s, in the late 40s and early 50s, of course, it was all men. And as the, you know, mix, the gender balance in these places changed, and as the country moved towards the late 60s, there was a sense in which, you know, games like football, which used to represent the whole, didn't quite mean the same thing. Now, when I was at Yale, football was still a pretty big deal. I mean, you know, the Harvard-Yale game, you know, the game as it's called, you know, it filled up the Yale Bowl. And I mean, that was a thrill. But I don't, you know, my classmates, I mean, a lot of them didn't, you know, why should they care about football? They weren't there, you know, to be, they were part of a different, the community was different, okay? When I got to Yale, it was much different than it was when my dad was there. And I think that for the guys that I played football with, you know, I think that for many of them, football meant an awful lot to them. And football brought them to the university in certain ways. And so within the football community, and I would say this would be true for other sports as well, there was quite a lot of, you know, the commitment was 100%. But, you know, there was a way in which, and I, as you know, I write about this in the book, there was a way in which, you know, those of us who were on the football field, at least on the football team, at least some of us, I think, felt a little bit, you know, we were vaguely alienated from the student body, you know, because this was a time when, you know, it was much more common to look askance at football players in the, you know, late 60s and early 70s than it was in the 50s. I'll put it that way.
Yeah, well, and it's interesting. You like me, you're not a big pro football fan anymore. You've seen games in one of the most beautiful Division III stadiums you'll ever sit in anywhere. At Middlebury. Seen kids play there. And what I found is my son played football and ran track his four years at Middlebury. And one of the things that he said is that he really felt it was one of the few places he'd ever been where there was more of a nexus between athletes and non-athletes than a lot of other schools. Do you think by big time football in college has lost that by segregating their athletes in their own dorms and their own kind of insular world?
Well, I mean, I have an opinion about that, but I guess one of the things I learned in writing this book is that, you know, the experience that I was trying to talk about in my book was my experience. So, I mean, I'm loath to sort of make judgments about how other athletes might be experiencing their, you know, the time they're spending at some of these big time schools where, in fact, they are segregated. Now, I mean, but to answer your question flat out, I think it's too bad. I mean, and I think that at Middlebury and at places like Middlebury and other NESCAC schools, It is true that athletes, you know, have a slightly different status. I mean, they're treated different in the admissions process, but I think the institution goes out of its way to make sure that they have, that students have that kind of integrated experience that your son had. And I think that's really important. So in that respect, I think, you know, there's a way in which NESCAC is continuing to hold up an ideal that, you know, is maybe, well, it is much more difficult to hold up at other institutions. I mean, even Ivy League schools now, I mean, I think they have spring football. And, you know, when I was at Yale, as I write about, I mean, we had a freshman football team, and the idea was that we could have a special kind of athletic experience that we wouldn't have if we were immediately integrated into the varsity team. And that's all gone now for, you know, economic reasons. And I think that's probably too bad. So, yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, in back in the day, right, I mean, the ideal experience was, you know, you apply to college, you go to university, you know, you go out for a team and you make it and you get to play. Now it's, you know, the situation or the process for finding yourself on an athletic field, you know, at almost all institutions is much more specialized and very rigorous.
I thought the book ends on, and I don't want to give too much away, but a wonderfully poignant note involving your son, who is not the fourth generation of Spears football players, and yet the bond in the family of athletics continues in its own unique and beautiful way.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate you saying that. I mean, the end of the book was very important to me. And, you know, look, I'll just say that my son is not typically developing guy. He's on the autism spectrum, and yet he's, you know, 6'2", 290 pounds. And, you know, he's got very large hands and feet and arms, and he wasn't going to play football, but you know, he would have done something if he had, I think.
Well, it really is a wonderful book, Spirals: A Family's Education in Football, Timothy B. Spears. Tim, love the book, and so great that you were able to come on and talk with us about it. Thank you so much.
Well, I really appreciate you thinking of me. I'm glad you liked the book, and you know, this has been a lot of fun, so thanks so much.
Yeah, it was really great, Tim. Thanks an awful lot for being with us.
Okay, you guys take care.
Timothy B. Spears here on Downtown Spirals, A Family's Education in Football.
And it's, you know, if you're a fan of any sport anywhere, I think reading this book and watching this man decide what it is that football was to him, is to him, may have been to him, whatever, is a journey that a lot of people should take in looking back at their past and how athletics affected him, you know, because this is not one of those, the older I get, the better I was. Mm. This is a real honest look. And I am, yeah, I really like the book. It's a book I'll read again, I think. Yeah. I really enjoyed it.
And it's a quick read, too.
Yes, yes, very quick.
It was excellent. Next week on the program, Kevin Cowherd.
Yeah, we're going to talk about the only Major League Baseball game in which no fans were allowed to attend, which is broadcast by Gary Thorne and Jim Palmer. And it's a really interesting book, Kevin Cowherd. Yeah, The Day the Crowd Didn't Roar.
And I think we're going to set the stage for that on Tuesday when Gary will be with us to talk about what it was like broadcasting a game with nobody in attendance.
Yeah, I'm going to stick around town. So if Gary's here, I would love to be in on that.